This is the Waters and Harvey Show. I'm Darren Waters.
And I'm Marcus Harvey.
It remains one of the most contentious periods in American history. Reconstruction, that period that followed the American Civil War. What is the legacy of Reconstruction, especially to this region of our state? We'll explore this question on today's show. Back in a moment. Again, this is the Waters and Harvey Show. I'm Darren Waters. Again, glad to have you all joining us in the audience. Glad to be here, as always, with my brother and co-host, Dr. Marcus Harvey. Marcus, here we are again. How are you, brother?
Yeah, excited to be here. How are you?
I'm doing well. Yeah. Doing well, ready to jump into this conversation about Reconstruction. This is an interesting period in American history, a period that I focus on in my own own academic work. But it's always good to go back to this period. And I don't know if people really realize it. We are essentially in the sesquicentennial of the American Reconstruction era. Mm. In fact, 150 years ago, in December, the Congress, National Congress, passed the Reconstruction Acts of 1867, which changed the whole dynamic of Reconstruction. We're going to talk a little bit about that today.
Yeah, and I think, just thinking about Reconstruction, I mean, I think some historians have argued that the Civil War is essential to sort of understanding sort of what it means to be American, right? Mm-hmm. Well, I would sort of add to that that Reconstruction might be, or probably is, just as important as to understanding what it means historically, socially, politically, culturally, to be an American citizen.
I think that you're very right. And it makes me think about one historian who referred to this period of Reconstruction as America's second Civil War. So the guest that we have today, we're going to talk to him about that to see what he thinks about that. Mm-hmm. Because I always raise the question, was it America's second Civil War? Because it was such a contentious period. Mm-hmm. And I also think about questions like this, Marcus, well, what was this period that we refer to as Reconstruction? Do we really understand what it was? Mm-hmm. We focus so much of our attention on the American Civil War, but a lot of the attention that's given the American Civil War, we don't get that much attention to this period that followed from 1865 to 1877. Yeah. So questions like, what was this period that we refer to as Reconstruction, and how much do we really know about it? It makes me think again about my mentor, Dr. John Hope Franklin. I know that in a 1979 essay entitled Mirror for America, which was kind of a play on his autobiography years later would be titled Mirror to America, and our listeners have heard us refer to that. But in this 1979 essay entitled Mirror for America, A Century of Reconstruction History, Dr. Franklin observed that the process of reconciling a society that has been torn apart by civil conflict is often as contentious as the conflict itself. And I believe that no truer statement could be made about the post-Civil War, the Reconstruction period in American history.
Yeah, and as we were saying briefly before the show, I mean, when you consider what preceded the Civil War, right, centuries of forced servitude, the brutality that went along with that, that has been well documented by historians and others, the question is begged. I think despite the voluminous literature on Reconstruction of what was reconstructed,
right?
I mean, how does a country reconcile itself to the brutal history that preceded the Civil War? Can this kind of reconciliation be accomplished?
Right. And you think about, you know, one of the larger questions of this period was Reconstruction a failure? You know, and it's interesting to look at some of the work that historians have done on this period, because early historians would write that it was an absolute failure. And one major historian here in North Carolina who wrote the history of Reconstruction for the state, which I think is a study that is begging to be rewritten at some point. But a professor at Chapel Hill, Hamilton Hall, is named for this particular professor. At one point in his essay, he actually made the argument that Reconstruction was an attempt to Africanize North Carolina, the American South. But did that really happen? Another person who came and challenged a lot of what was written in the early period about the Reconstruction in this period was W.E.B. Du Bois. And our listeners have heard us talk about W.E.B. Du Bois for a lot over the course of the shows that we've been doing.
Very interesting, because when I think about Reconstruction, the last thing that comes to mind is Africanization.
Right. So.
Very interesting argument.
So we will explore this today on today's show with our guest, Dr. Stephen Nash, who we will come and talk to in just a few minutes. So stay with us. You are listening to the Waters and Harvey Show, and Marcus and I are always glad to have you all here with us, and we're glad that you're staying with us, listening to what I believe is a very, very important conversation for us to have, to talk about Reconstruction. And so we're happy to have here in the studio with us as our guest, Dr. Stephen Nash, who is an associate professor of history at East Tennessee State University in Johnson City, Tennessee. And just last year, University of North Carolina Press published the book, Reconstruction's Ragged Edge, The Politics of Postwar Life in the Southern Mountains, which is Steve's book, which is a remarkable book, which I've had the opportunity to read. Marcus has read it as well. And we really encourage you to go out and find this particular book to learn more about, especially about this particular region and the experience, the Reconstruction experience here. So, Steve, we're really glad and honored to have you here in the studio with us. Welcome to the show.
Welcome, Steve.
It's a pleasure to be with you both. Thank you.
You know, Steve, I didn't want to go too extensively into your background because we always like to give our guests an opportunity to tell us a little bit more. It's better to hear it from them than it is us. But could you tell us a little bit more about your background and one of the things that, you know, your personal, what do you want to tell us about that, your educational background? And I'm also interested in, you know, eventually getting to what was it about this particular period that attracted you to study it?
Okay. I'm originally from Pennsylvania, so I'm not from the South. I'm not from Southern Appalachia. Was not familiar with Asheville, Western North Carolina, until I came here for my master's degree. I went to Western Carolina University, which was a huge jump. Grew up in New Jersey, went to Penn State as an undergraduate. So I went from, you know, 40, 50,000 students to Cullowhee, which is a very different place. Grew to love it there. And one of the key things for me is, you know, growing up in central New Jersey, then you come down to Western North Carolina, and it's, you're trying to find a topic that resonates. You're trying to find sort of a hook. And my undergraduate interest was in Civil War loyalties. And what I quickly realized was, what better place to be to consider the nature of wartime loyalty than in the Southern Mountains, where things were very divided. People were split on both sides of the issue, and started looking around for, you know, how to see how that would play out. And very quickly in conversation with my advisor decided, well, Reconstruction. Nobody's really looked at Reconstruction. And what an interesting place to study, consider the topic.
It is.
Because there is no clear line. Most people try to make Reconstruction and the war linear, and there's no neatness to this period in this area. So
I'm hearing that you probably agree with Dr. Franklin's view on this, that it probably more contentious than the war itself, right?
I would. And in fact, you know, that's where sort of Civil War scholars are going. A lot of people, if you even go back to the mid-80s, you had George Rabel and others who are arguing that the war did not end in Appomattox, that it redefined, it became different. And it's sort of the old Clausewitz argument. If war is politics by other means, then Reconstruction suggests that politics was war by other means, in which the violence permeated and, you know, the lines continuously to redraw.
It's amazing. Now, I know that before Marcus jumps in here into the conversation too, that you studied with John Ensco, right, at University of Georgia. So you left Western Carolina University and went on to University of Georgia. How was it studying with John? I mean, John is one of those names that our listeners have heard before as well, but just a great historian.
Oh, great historian, better person. It was one of those things that I went down to meet with him before I even went there, and he's so unaware of how good he actually is as a scholar that when he asked me, you know, why do you want to come to Athens? What do you want to do here? It was almost like he was fishing for, you know, me to come out and be like, well, I love REM, so I want to live in Athens. And I looked at him, and I said, just point blank, you're here. Like, you're the whole reason why I want to come here. You've done the secession crisis. You co-authored the book on the war. There's no place that I could do this project, no better person than to work with you. Yeah. And he was completely almost flabbergasted that, oh, well, okay.
He's a very humble person, but he's an institution.
Oh, he is.
He really, really is.
Very much so.
Steve, and you know, I think Darren sort of started to bring this up. I'm curious to hear from you. You mentioned or you alluded to the fact that the period of Reconstruction isn't as heavily studied by historians as the Civil War, for instance. Why? Can you say more about why that is?
I think part of it is it doesn't have the sort of personalities. You know, there's Lincoln's dead. Mm-hmm. So you sort of lose that. And as I often point out to my undergraduate students, right, there's only, I think, one person in American history who's written about Moore on an annual basis. At least this was true. A couple years ago, read a book, I think it was Merrill Peterson, that said that the only person that had more written on them in the United States in an annual period than Lincoln was Jesus at that time. So you lose that personality, you lose that figure, you lose all the main sort of key wartime figures. A lot of them transition, they, you know, they lose some of their heroism, if you will. And I think the other part is that Reconstruction for the longest time had been sort of successfully depicted as a crime. Early scholars had depicted it as a crime against the South, a sort of aberration in American history of violence and where democracy didn't appear to work. And in that case, it was almost just kind of shuffled to the side and better forgotten, an aberration in this otherwise sort of linear, progressive narrative. And I mean that in a sort of every era improves on the other sort of way. That it just didn't fit. It didn't fit the sort of story that we like to tell ourselves about ourselves. And a couple of years ago, I was at a conference, and historian Stephen Hahn made his whole focus point was, what if this period is us, right? What if Reconstruction is sort of the core of American history? What if violence has always been part of the equation? What if democracy isn't neat? What if it's always messy? What if you have these sorts of conflicts and parties hemorrhaging and changing and transforming? So that, to me, was one of the sort of key points, which is, what if this is a period that really speaks to some of the inner workings of the institutional problems within the American government?
Well, see, you're bringing up very interesting questions here. And in my mind, where my mind is going here to lead us into this next question is that as you looked at Western North Carolina, as you said again, a place, well, the Southern Mountains, not a place that was heavily studied for this particular period, because you can correct me if I'm wrong here, but it seems to me that when we think about Reconstruction, we want to look at it as a black-white issue, but it was not, right? And you clearly show that by looking, focusing on this region of the state of North Carolina and the Southern Mountains in general. Can you just tell us a little bit about this? Because, I mean, in the book, I mean, the complexity of the period, I just want to say that I think that you handled the complexity of this period in a way that I couldn't even begin to wrap my mind around to get this done, but because it is very complex. So could you just explain to our listeners what is unique about Western North Carolina, because it is not a black-white issue. There's so many other things that are going on.
Well, I think, you know, if you look at Reconstruction broadly, and this is on the broadest plane, and this brings us, you mentioned W.B. Du Bois, Reconstruction is fundamentally about two things. It's about the end of slavery and the definition of African-American freedom, and it's about restoring the Union. And the fundamental thing about that is, if it's about African-American freedom, if African-American civil rights are central to that, which they fundamentally are, then what happens when you bring it into a region where African-Americans constitute such a distinct minority of the population? And suddenly the basic narrative of Reconstruction changes. The conflict over labor changes. The sort of white fears of redefinition of citizenship and African-Americans changing position within society functions differently. And what you see is the sort of white population fractures. And in some ways, that was an old fissure. You had the sort of, you know, the old Whigs, the sort of middle class, law and order, economic, progressive folks. And then you have the sort of Democrats who are the sort of Andrew Jackson common people, sort of. And you go back into that anti-bum period, and they were all about economic improvement. They were all about these sorts of things. And you bring that forward, and the questions become, who's going to benefit? How are these political coalitions going to redefine? Is economics still in sort of the pursuit of railroads and sorts of things? Is that still fundamental to who we are? And the idea of African-American freedom is not a central issue to them. It's a fundamental part to the region. And as part of the region, they're going to grapple with that. But they divide amongst themselves over who's going to have control, who's going to be locally in power. And you have these sort of changes of the election of county officers for the first time. you have sort of an expansion, what Paul Escott sort of refers to as a massive expansion of democracy with a small d during the Reconstruction period in North Carolina. And that creates all sorts of opportunities for lower class whites to try to assert themselves against an elite that had previously dominated.
Yeah, go ahead, Marcus.
this is good stuff. Steve, so you mentioned earlier that one of the reasons that possibly that historians have played on average have paid less attention to Reconstruction is because of a sort of lack of interesting figures. Mm-hmm. And that to me leads to the question of, well, who were some of the key players during Reconstruction in this particular region?
Yeah, that's a great question.
Based on your research.
Yeah, that's mm-hmm. a great question. The one that I always come back to, because in some ways he's emblematic of the region, and that's a man by the name of Virgil Lusk. And Virgil Lusk was from Buncombe County, but it's a section of Buncombe County that gets carved off into Madison County. And he was a lawyer. He was a volunteer Confederate cavalryman. So he went and fought for the Confederacy. He was captured during the war, spent a good portion of the war in a prisoner of war camp. And then afterwards, when he came home, he becomes a Republican. In 1867, he sort of sides with the Republican Party. In his sort of terminology, he essentially surrenders his sword and the cause and transitions into the realities of this post-war America. And I find him emblematic in that sense, because here's a Confederate who, once the war is over, shifts again, right? He becomes a Republican. He, to a time where, to most white Southerners, to become a Republican is, you know, you're Judas. You've gone, you've betrayed your region, you've betrayed your communities, you've betrayed, in many cases, they would argue, you betrayed your race.
Right.
And so he becomes a Republican and will become an active sort of prosecutor as district solicitor, active prosecutor of the Ku Klux Klan, where he's going to exert a lot of influence and a lot of effort to try to prosecute Klansmen in Western North Carolina in the early 1870s. And he's going to remain a Republican for the rest of his life.
Wow.
That's the thing I find fascinating, because he lives all the way into the 1920s.
Wow.
So
wow.
He will become a Teddy Roosevelt Republican. He will sort of support Roosevelt against Taft in the 19-teens. I mean, he's a fascinating individual, and he just carries on. And in some ways, that's also representative that the sort of persistent Republicanism in a region in Western North Carolina, while the rest of the South overwhelmingly shifts back towards white democracy.
Right, right.
In terms of other figures, there's people that I've often tried to sort of figure out, and Darren can tell you, doing research on this area, and particularly looking for African Americans in this area, is extremely difficult.
Mm-hmm.
They don't leave a lot of written records, the sorts of bread and butter things that historians depend on. And one of them is a fellow by the name of Alfred Stokes, who was Wilkes County. Yeah, minister, not exactly sure of what church, but he was a minister, a former slave, becomes a Republican leader as well. And he gets wrapped up in this sort of 1867 fight in Wilkesboro in the county courthouse. Republicans were holding a meeting. Democrats, conservatives come in and try to demand equal speaking time. And supposedly, Stokes makes the comment of something along the lines of, well, the Republicans aren't giving us equal share of offices and elected offices and political clout. And this precipitates this big fight in which people are pulling out, you know, basically the equivalent of boards with nails in it and all sorts of other stuff, guns and knives, and turns into this big brawl. Mm-hmm. He becomes a state Republican leader. Mm-hmm. He goes on for a while. He moves off to Iredell County, but helped to organize a lot of schools in Wilkes County. He was a major force in the development of African-American schools in Wilkes County in the 1860s. He's a significant figure. On a state level, you know, it's William Woods Holden, mm-hmm. The sort of political chameleon Republican governor, provisional governor, and then later elected governor. Zebulon Vance looms
large.
Like he does in much of Western North Carolina, looms large, often sometimes more as a symbol as well as what he actually says.
Yeah, the one man who, and I can't remember his name right now, but he was the editor publisher of the Hendersonville
right.
Pioneer, which becomes the Asheville Pioneer.
Right.
What was his name?
He great name for a unionist, mm-hmm. Alexander Hamilton Jones.
Okay.
Alexander Hamilton Jones. He and a person of quite a bit of controversy, Alexander Hamilton Jones. He was the only white congressman elected from the state of North Carolina in 1865, at the time where southern states were increasingly or overwhelmingly electing former Confederates to go mm-hmm. off to Congress. Mm-hmm. Jones was the only person in the state of North Carolina who could take the quote-unquote ironclad oath of loyalty to the Union that was elected to
right.
Congress in 1865. Right. He ran the Hendersonville Pioneer, moves it to Asheville, critical Republican leader through the 1860s, and he's a central player in the election riot that
right.
takes place in Asheville in November of 1868.
That's right. Yep. Now, you bring up here, too, Steve, there's so many questions that just grow out of the things that you've already said. But one of the major issues that was involved here, and you bring this out in your book very well, and I think, as I see it, is building off of work that people like Paul Escott have done in looking at North Carolina, and in his book, I think Many Excellent People is the title of his mm-hmm. book, which I think he really concludes that North Carolina is really one of the most undemocratic states in the Union, which mm-hmm. is interesting because there's a study that came out not too long ago that is placing North Carolina back in that category again. But Paul Escott is saying that early, pre-Civil War, post-Civil War period. Because you said this is a major question about who is going to be in power, who is going to control power.
Right.
And so there's an effort, based on what I read in your book, to redefine what the leadership of the region is going to be.
Mm-hmm.
So you're looking at a number of different groups, African Americans. You have African Americans, even though it's a small population mm-hmm. here. You have Unionists, mm-hmm. people who supported the Union. And then you have this group, which is really interesting. Can you explain this for our listeners that you call the Anti-Confederates?
Yeah, the Anti-Confederates, which is a sort of umbrella term for the sort of hodgepodge of people. It's former Confederates who are disgruntled, the sort of, you know, or in some cases the Virgil Lusks who give up mm-hmm. the cause, the people who felt like they got emotionally pulled into the war and then afterwards decided that, okay, we made a mistake, and they sort of come back to the Union. People who are economically upwardly mobile who mm-hmm. see this as opportunity. Yeah, it's this sort of broad group. The Unionists, you would think, are sort of the spiritual leaders of it, if you will, but they slowly embrace African Americans and sort of create this biracial group that is able to sort of seize power, particularly in the 1867-68 period when
right.
federal Congress sort of comes in and says, okay, well, what we're doing under President Johnson isn't working. We're going to take this in a different path. So there is sort of this key group. And of course, you know, another element of that would be the Freedmen's Bureau, the sort of outside group that's going to come in, sort of get back to our people of major figures in this area at this time.
Right.
I'd be sort of remiss if I didn't bring up Oscar Eastman.
Yeah.
He's an
interesting guy who became mayor of Asheville.
For a short time.
That's right.
For a couple months. Yeah,
there's so much here, Steve, so much complexity. A question that I would pose as time sort of winds down on us is how would you characterize the legacy of Reconstruction in this region? I mean, as Darren has pointed out, we were talking about a number of different groups who had a political stake in right. Reconstruction during in this particular region. What's the legacy in your perspective?
Right. I think the key to sort of my overall book is I look at Reconstruction as sort of that Eric Foner, unfinished revolution, mm-hmm. moment lost period, that here was this opportunity where African Americans and whites of different persuasions were actually able to come together to create a political coalition that took control and had a sort of momentum going in terms of creating new institutions and new sort of structures. And I think sort of the legacy of that is the backlash, the sort of the stopping of that. The sort of reaction to it. It's not that the Republicans were destroyed or that these groups just kind of, you know, vanished in the 1880s, but they lose the sort of access to federal power. They lose mm-hmm. the federal ear. They lose the sort of trust in some ways between them that made it possible. And that sort of shift back towards sort of suppression of, you know, voters, of making it harder for people to vote, sort of intimidating people away from the polls. You know, it's hard not to see parallels between Reconstruction and certain things going on now in terms of, you know, access to the ballot power, and how those sorts of things are done. I mean, that's almost the 1890s style. And I think that's one of the sad legacies of Reconstruction, is that here was this moment where the country really had an opportunity to sort of, for lack of a better word, to sort of embrace its founding principle. And failed to do it. And that's not to say that Reconstruction was a total failure, right? Slavery is gone. That's a fundamental change that cannot be understated. But the sort of realization of sort of a true sort of freedom for all, you know, it comes back. Abraham Lincoln had this great sort of description, sort of understanding, where in the secession crisis, he says that the Constitution, the Declaration of Independence, are like a golden apple against a frame of silver. And in his metaphor, the golden apple was the Declaration of Independence and the frame of silver was the Constitution. And what happened is, he said, we've become too obsessed with the frame, and the frame is there to accentuate the apple, not the other way around. And Reconstruction was that sort of moment, like the apple was there and it and sort it of got lost.
And I tell you, one thing that you bring out in this book very well, Steve, is that politics is a nasty game. It's a very nasty business. And there's so much more that we can talk about here, but we're coming down to the last few minutes of the show. And I knew before we started this conversation that we were probably going to have to do a second conversation with you about this, because there's so many more. The Ku Klux Klan and its activities here in Western North Carolina looks a little different from the way that it does in other parts of the state. And this comes out in your book very well. So we want to remind you all again in the audience that the title of Steve's book is Reconstruction's Ragged Edge. And we really encourage you to go out and get this book. We want to thank Steve for coming in and talking about the things that he did today. And this is really only scratching the surface of this book. And so we want to get him back in here again. So I'm going to make him promise me now that he will come back and have this conversation, further conversation with us about this topic. Again, Marcus.
Yeah, I think this was a great conversation. And one of the things that that stays with me that Steve said earlier was, are we Reconstruction? Is Reconstruction us? And I would invite our listeners to consider that.
A very good way to end it, as always. And again, Steve, thanks for being here. Marcus and I again want to remind you that the Waters and Harvey Show is produced right here in Asheville, North Carolina, at Blue Ridge Public Radio.
And you can listen to our podcast on BPR.org, on the BPR mobile app, and on iTunes and Google Play.
Follow us and get in touch on Facebook and Twitter. We'll be back next time. Bye-bye.